Chapter 57. Pitt could not escape the feeling he was being deserted on a lonely island as he stood on the foredeck of the Titanic and watched the salvage fleet get underway and begin moving toward the western horizon and safer waters. The Alhambra was the last in line to slip past, her captain flashing a good luck with his Andes lamp, the newspeople quietly, solemnly filming what might be the last visual record of the Titanic. Pitt searched for Dana Seagram among the crowd gathered at the railings, but his eyes failed to pick her out. He watched the ships until they became small, dark specks on a leaden sea. Only the missile cruiser Juno and the Capricorn remained behind, but the salvage tender would soon depart and follow the others once the tug captain signaled they had the derelict in tow. "Mr. Pitt?" Pitt turned to see a man who had the face of a canvas-weary prizefighter and the body of a beer keg. "Chief Bascom, sir, of the Wallace. I brought a two-man crew aboard to make fast the towing cable." Pitt smiled a friendly smile. "I bet they call you Bad Bascom." "Only behind my back. It's a name that's followed me ever since I tore up a bar in San Diego." Bascom shrugged. Then his eyes narrowed. "How'd you guess?" "Commander Butera described you in glowing terms. Behind your back, that is."
"A good man, the commander."
"How long will it take for the hookup?"
"With luck and the loan of your helicopter, about an hour."
"No problem over the helicopter. It belongs to the Navy anyway." Pitt turned and gazed down at the Wallace as Butera very carefully backed the tug toward the Titanic's old straight-up-and-down bow until he was less than 100 feet away. "I take it the helicopter is to lift the tow cable on board."
"Yes, sir," Bascom answered. "Our cable measures 10 inches in diameter and weighs in at 1 ton for 70 feet. No lightweight, that one.
On most tow jobs, we'd cast a small line over the derelict's bow, which in turn would be attached to a series of heavier lines with increasing diameters that finally tied into the main cable.
But that type of operation calls for the services of an electric winch, and since the Titanic's a dead ship, and human muscles are way undermatched for the job, we take the easy way out. No sense in filling up sick bay with a crew of hernia patients."
Even with the help of the helicopter, it was all Bascom and his men could do to secure the great cable into position. Sturgis came through like an old pro. Tenderly manipulating the helicopter's controls, he laid the end of the Wallace's tow cable on the Titanic's focal deck as neatly as though he'd practiced the trick for years. It took only 50 minutes from the time Sturgis released the cable and flew back to the Capricorn until Chief Bascom stood on the forepeak and waved his arms over his head, signaling the tugs that the connection was made. Butera, on the Wallace, acknowledged the signal with a blast on the tug's whistle and rang the engine room for dead ahead slow, as uphill on the Morse went through the same motions. Slowly, the two tugs gathered way, the Wallace trailing the Morse on 300 yards of wire leash, paying out the main cable until the Titanic rose and dropped in the steadily increasing swells, nearly a quarter of a mile astern. Then Butera held up his hand, and the men on the Wallace's afterdeck gently eased on the brake of the tug's immense towing winch, and the cable took up the strain. From atop the Titanic's vast height, the tugs looked like tiny toy boats tossing over the enormous crests of the waves one moment before disappearing to their mast lights in the cavernous troughs the next. It seemed impossible that such puny objects could budge over 45,000 tons of dead weight. And yet, slowly, imperceptibly at first, their combined forces of 10,000 horsepower began to tell, and soon a minute dog's bone of foam could be discerned curling around the Titanic's faded plimsoll's mark. She was barely making way. New York was still 1,200 miles to the west, but she had at last picked up where she'd left off that cold night back in 1912 and was once again making for port. The ominous-looking black clouds rose and spilled over the southern horizon. It was a hurricane bar. Even as Pitt watched, it seemed to expand and strengthen, turning the sea to a dark shade of dirty gray. Oddly, the wind became light, aimlessly changing direction every few seconds. He noticed that the seagulls that had once swarmed about the salvage fleet were not in view. Only the sight of the Juno, moving steadily 500 yards abeam the Titanic, provided any sense of security. Pitt glanced at his watch, and then took another look over the port railing, before he slowly, almost casually, approached the entrance to the gymnasium.
"Is the gang all here?"
"They're getting restless as hell," Giardino said. He was standing huddled against a ventilator in a seemingly vain attempt to hide from the icy wind. "If it wasn't for the Admiral's restraining influence, you'd have had a first-class riot on your hands."
"Everyone's accounted for?"
"To a man."
"You're positive?"
"Take the word of Warden Giardino. None of the inmates have left the room, not even to go potty."
"Then I guess it's my turn to enter stage right."
"Any complaints from our guests?" Giardino asked.
"The usual. Never satisfied with their accommodations. Not enough heat or too much air conditioning, you know."
"Yeah, I know."
"You'd better go aft and see about making their wait enjoyable."
"For God's sake, how?"
"Tell them jokes."
Giardino gave Pitt a sour look and mumbled dryly to himself as he turned and walked off into the evening's dimming light. Pitt checked his watch once more and entered the gymnasium. 3 hours had passed since the tow had begun, and the final act of the salvage had settled down to a routine. Sandecker and Gunn were bent over the radio, pestering Farquhar on the Capricorn, now 50 miles to the west, for the latest news on Hurricane Amanda, while the rest of the crew was grouped in a tight semicircle around a small and thoroughly inadequate oil-burning stove. As Pitt entered, they had all looked up expectantly. When at last he spoke, his voice was unnaturally soft in the unnatural quiet that was broken only by the hum of the portable generators. "My apologies, gentlemen, for keeping you waiting, but I thought the short coffee break would reconstitute your sagging sinews."
"Cut the satire," Spencer snapped, his voice taut with irritation. "You call us all up here and then make us sit around for half an hour when there's work to do. What's the story?"
"The story is simple," Pitt said evenly. "In a few minutes, Lieutenant Sturgis will drop his helicopter on board one last time before the storm strikes. With the exception of Giardino and myself, I would like all of you, and that includes you, Admiral, to return with him to the Capricorn."
"Aren't you out of your depth, Pitt?"
Sandecker said in an unemphatic tone. "To some degree, yes, sir, but I firmly believe I'm doing the right thing."
"Explain yourself."
Sandecker glowed like a piranha about to gulp a goldfish. He was playing his role to the hilt. It was an epic job of typecasting. "I have every reason to believe the Titanic hasn't the structural strength left to weather a hurricane.
This old tub has taken more punishment than any man-made object since the pyramids," Spencer said. "And now the great seer of the future, Dirk Pitt, predicts the old girl will throw in the sponge and sink at the first blow from a lousy storm."
"There's no guarantee she can't or won't founder under a heavy sea," Pitt hedged. "Either way, it's stupid to risk any more lives than we have to."
"Let me see if I get this straight."
Drummer leaned forward, his hawk-like features intent and angry. "Except for you and Giardino, the rest of us are supposed to haul ass and ditch everything we've busted our balls to achieve over the last 9 months, just so's we can hide on the Capricorn till the storm blows over? Is that the idea?"
"You go to the head of the class, Drummer."
"Man, you're out of your gourd."
"Impossible," Spencer said. "It takes 4 men just to oversee the pumps."
"And the hull below the waterline has to be sounded around the clock for new leaks," Gunn added.
"You heroes are all alike," Drummer drawled. "Always making noble sacrifices to save others. Let's face it, ain't no way 2 men can ride herd on this old tub. I vote we all stay."
Spencer turned and read the faces of his 6-man crew. They all stared back at him out of eyes red-rimmed with lack of sleep, and nodded in chorus. Then Spencer faced Pitt again.
"Sorry, great leader, but Spencer and his merry band of pump pushers have decided to hang in there."
I'm with you, Woodson said solemnly.
Count me in, said Gunn.
Chief Bascom touched Pitt on the arm.
Begging your pardon, sir, but me and my boys are for sticking around, too. That cable out there has to be checked every hour during the storm for signs of chafing, and heavy grease applied to the ferret to prevent a break.
Sorry, Pitt, my boy, Sandecker said with a marked degree of satisfaction. You lose.
The sound of Sturgis's helicopter was heard hovering for a landing over the lounge roof.
Pitt shrugged resignedly and said,
Well, that settles it then. We all sink or swim together.
Then he cracked a tired smile.
You'd all better get some rest and some food in your stomachs. It may be your last chance. A few hours from now, we'll be up to our eyeballs in the front quadrant of the hurricane, and I don't have to draw a picture of what we can expect.
He swung on his heels and walked out the door to the helicopter pad.
Not a bad performance, he thought to himself. Not a bad performance at all.
He'd never be nominated for an Academy Award, but what the hell? His captive audience had thought it convincing, and that's all that really mattered.
Jack Sturgis was a short, thin man with sad, drooping eyes, the kind women considered bedroom eyes. He gripped a long cigarette holder between his teeth and jutted his chin forward in a show reminiscent of Franklin Roosevelt. He'd just climbed down from the cockpit of the helicopter and seemed to be groping for something under the landing gear when Pitt stepped onto the pad.
Sturgis looked up.
Any passengers? He asked.
Not this trip.
Sturgis nonchalantly flicked an ash from his cigarette holder.
I knew I should have stayed cuddled in my warm, cozy cabin on the Capricorn, he sighed. Flying in the face of hurricanes will be the death of me yet.
You better get going, Pitt said. The wind will be on us any time now.
Makes no difference, Sturgis shrugged indifferently. I'm not going anywhere.
Pitt looked at him.
What do you mean by that?
I've been had, that's what I mean.
He gestured up at the rotor blades. The 2-foot tip of one was hanging down like a limp wrist.
Somebody around here resents whirlybirds.
Did you strike a bulkhead on landing?
Sturgis put on a hurt expression.
I do not. Repeat, do not strike objects upon landing.
He found what he was searching for and straightened up.
Here, see for yourself. Some son of a bitch tossed a hammer into my rotor blades.
Pitt took the hammer and examined it. The rubber hand grip showed a deep gash where it had come in contact with the blade.
And after all I've done for you people, Sturgis said. This is how you show your appreciation.
Sorry, Sturgis, but I suggest you forget any aspirations of ever becoming a television detective. You sadly lack an analytical mind, and you're prone to leap to false conclusions.
Get off it, Pitt. Hammers don't fly through the air without a means of propulsion. One of your people must have tossed it when I was landing.
Wrong. I can vouch for the whereabouts of every soul on board this ship, and no one was anywhere near the helicopter pad in the last 10 minutes. Whoever your little destructive friend is, I'm afraid you brought him with you.
You think I'm a dead brain? Don't you think I'd know if I carried a passenger? Besides, now you're insinuating a suicidal act. If that hammer had been thrown 1 minute sooner, when we were 100 feet in the air, you and your crew would have had an ugly mess to clean up.
Wrong nomenclature, Pitt said. Not passenger, but stowaway.
And he's no dead brain, either. He waited until your wheels kissed the deck before he made his play and escaped through the cargo hatch.
God only knows where he's hiding now. A thorough search of 50 miles of pitch-dark passageways and compartments is impossible.
Sturgis's face suddenly paled.
Christ, our intruder is still in the copter.
Don't be ridiculous. He beat it the instant you landed.
No, no. It's possible to throw a hammer out and up through an open cabin window into the rotor blades, but escape is something else again.
I'm listening, Pitt said quietly.
The cargo compartment hatch is electronically operated and can only be activated from a switch in the control cabin.
Is there another exit?
Only a door to the control cabin.
Pitt studied the sealed cargo hatch for a long moment, then turned back to Sturgis, his eyes cold. Is this any way to treat an unexpected guest? I think the appropriate thing to do is for us to invite him into the fresh air. Sturgis became rooted to the deck as he spotted the Colt 45 automatic, complete with silencer, that had suddenly materialized in Pitt's right hand.
Sure, sure, he stammered. If you say so.
Sturgis clambered up the ladder to the control cabin, leaned in, and pushed a switch. The electric motors made a whirring sound, and the contoured 7-foot by 7-foot door rose open and upward over the helicopter's fuselage. Even before the locking pins clicked into position, Sturgis was back on the deck and standing warily behind Pitt's broad shoulders. Half a minute after the door had opened, Pitt was still standing there. He stood there for what Sturgis thought was a lifetime without moving a muscle, breathing slowly and evenly and listening. The only sounds were the slap of the waves against the hull, the low whine of the steadily building wind over the Titanic superstructure, and the murmur of voices that carried through the gymnasium door, not the sounds he was tuned in for. When he was satisfied, there were no sounds of feet scraping, rustling of clothing, or other tones relating to menace or stealth. He stepped into the helicopter. The darkened skies outside dimmed the interior, and Pitt was uneasily aware that he was perfectly silhouetted against the dusk light. At first glance, the compartment seemed empty. But then Pitt felt a tapping on his shoulder and noted that Sturgis was pointing past him at a tarpaulin tucked around a human-like shape.
I neatly folded and stowed that tarp not more than an hour ago, Sturgis whispered.
Swiftly, Pitt reached down and dragged the tarpaulin away with his left hand, while aiming the Colt as steadily as a park statue with his right. A figure, enveloped in a heavy foul-weather jacket, lay huddled on the cargo deck, the eyes loosely closed in a state of unconsciousness that was obviously related to the ugly, bleeding, and purplish bruise just above the hairline. Sturgis stood rooted in the shadows in shocked immobility, his widening eyes blinking rapidly, still adjusting to the diminishing light. Then he rubbed his chin lightly with his fingers and shook his head in disbelief.
Good Lord, he muttered in awe.
Do you know who that is?
I do, Pitt answered evenly.
Her name is Seagram. Dana Seagram.